conference record has joined the conference.
Hi, good morning. Morning, everyone, and folks on the phone. This is Foster Gaston. I'm medical director in the Office of Health Insurance Programs, and we're going to get started on our basic benefit review work group. Thanks, everyone, for joining. I think we have just about everyone. We have one member, Kathy Scherer, who's on the phone, and Dr. Shaw may be joining us by phone at some point this morning or later this afternoon. Why don't we go around and introduce ourselves? This is it's a formal meeting, but it we're a small enough group to be informal as well. And let us know who you are and what you do. Sorry that we weren't able to do that in person at the first meeting. Appreciate the folks who were able to make it on the phone. And hopefully, for those of you that did not, having some of the background material was helpful. We're going to review a couple of things around our charge and our vision and the purpose of the group. I've already had some conversations with folks about what it is that we're here to do exactly, and we'll try to make that clearer and reiterate that. It's a pretty full agenda. We'll go over the agenda and some of the items, but why don't we go around and do introductions. So I'll start my colleagues, am I right?
Welcome, and I guess you got to push these, turn them on. Good morning. My name is Greg Allen. I work with Foster in the Office of Health Insurance Programs doing policy and planning, and I look forward to today's meeting and discussion.
Hi, I'm George Thomas. I'm a gynecologist representing ACOG. I'm associate professor of OBGYN. I do primarily teaching of primary care and family planning.
Feel free.
Good morning, I'm Arnold Saffersteen. I'm the president of Metro Plus Health Plan in New York City.
And I'm Peter Narold from the United Hospital Fund, the Health Insurance Project.
Hi, Kate Breslin, president and CEO at the Schuyler Center for Analysis and Advocacy.
Paloma Hernandez, president and CEO of Urban Health Plan. We're a network of community health centers in the Bronx and Queens.
Millie Lazar, I'm the Chief Quality Officer at the New York Presbyterian Hospital.
I'm Ira Lamstrom, the Dean of the College of Dental Medicine at Columbia University.
I'm Joe Stankitis. I'm the Chief Medical Officer for the Monroe Plan for Medical Care in Rochester, New York.
I'm Elizabeth Benjamin. I'm just the Vice President for All Policy at the
Gene Heslin, family practitioner from upstate New York. I chair the board of a couple hospitals as well, but mainly I practice primary care medicine.
Mark Gibson, I'm the director of the Center for Evidence-Based Policy out at Oregon Health and Science University and also a program officer for the Milbank Memorial Fund.
I'm Tony Greco. I'm a general internist at NYU, and I'm representing Doug DeLong from the New York ACP.
I'm Henry Chung. I'm Chief Medical Officer for Montefiore Care Management, and I'm also faculty in the Department of Psychiatry at Albert Einstein College of Medicine.
Dr. Chaudhary, I'm an internal medicine physician and a medical scientist at IBM Research.
I'm Ellie Ward, and I'm representing AAP New York State for Bob Corbin.
And Kathy on the phone.
This is Kathy Shore, Senior Vice President with the Greater New York Hospital Association. Apologize for not being there in person, but we had a conflicting board meeting that just finished.
Kathy, can you hear us okay? We can hear you pretty well.
Yep.
Great, terrific. So let me just say a little bit about the co-chairs. As you may know, Greg and I were supposed to be staff, but today our positions got elevated a little bit. Frank Brancini was unable to make it, although I think that we're supposed to have a representative. Oh, you're here. That's right. Feel free. Why don't you come up, Bill? Dr. Bill Gillespie from Emblem, and I'm going to give you this card, but you can write your name on it. I'm sorry. Why don't you introduce yourself?
Good morning. I'm Bill Gillespie, Chief Medical Officer for Emblem Health, representing Mr. Brancini this morning. Thank you.
And Dr. Shaw had a meeting with the governor, so he said. So he hopes to be on the line sometime this morning, and we'll try to make it back this afternoon as well and circle back. So Greg and I will be facilitating the meeting today, and one of the things we want to do is go over the agenda for today, then get into the charge and so on. So we're going to review the agenda, which we're doing now. We want to go through some of the materials that we distributed just to let you know where they came from, what they were responding to, if there were questions that were raised last time, what they relate to in the presentation. Spend some time, maybe a half an hour and 45 minutes or so, talking about the principles for benefit design document that was sent around that a number of you, along with us, helped to put a draft together. Mark Gibson from OHSU is going to talk a little bit about some of the opportunities, both looking at the national scene as well as the New York scene around benefits and benefit opportunities. We're going to drill down into a couple of different areas, looking at areas of both underuse and overuse, and then talk a little bit about a proposed benefit review process going forward and get some initial reaction and discussion, and then next steps. Last meeting, I think we distributed this, and this is on the PowerPoint, but just to recapitulate what our vision is and what it is that we're aiming towards, this is it. We're hoping to have, going forward, an evidence-informed benefit package. We can talk about what any of those words mean, which promotes high-quality, efficient, and effective services that improve health and healthcare outcomes for its members, for Medicaid. The second bullet is around having a process that's transparent, that we can sustain, that is a learning process to accomplish this that includes both internal and external stakeholders, as well as whatever content experts we need to do this. And we'll talk a little bit this afternoon, about a proposal for that process. So, getting into more specifically to our specific mission and charge, and we did send around a template for the report for the work groups, which we wanted you to see sooner rather than later, so you get a sense of what that report, what the pieces of that report look like. The notion that we're really aiming towards making specific recommendations with some information attached to those recommendations, for those of you that may have been involved in MRT1, some of that should look kind of familiar. But, you know, what we're looking for in terms of the output of the group is a set of specific recommendations to help us in benefit design and benefits going forward. So, as we talked about at the first meeting, the notion of reviewing every single benefit in detail using sort of state-of-the-art evidence and all the kinds of evaluations that Mark will be discussing today is plainly not possible. But at least from a certain vantage point, the group's charge is to review Medicaid benefits, including coverage criteria, copayment issues, both as they apply in fee-for-service and managed care, with specific suggestions regarding ways to promote what's in that vision, evidence-informed, cost-effective health services, within the overall parameter of budget neutrality in the Medicaid program, meaning that we have not been given license or charge to use this as a form to simply add new benefits. No one's given us a budget and said, yeah, that's much money to spend. It's really within the context of the budget parameters that we have currently, which is whatever new benefits need to have potential savings. Those savings can be short-term, medium-term, or long-term. Longer-term savings are always more difficult to get enacted, and or are coupled with other kinds of cuts and benefits that offset those investments. And I think that's part of the challenge that anyone doing benefit design has, is what to keep, what to save, and what to restrict, and that's part of the process that we're looking for input onto. The second part of the charge is making specific suggestions regarding the process going forward. So this is a time-limited process. We all, as much as we love you all, we're gonna say goodbye to you at the end of October or sometime or early November. So how do we take the ideas and thoughts from the group and create a process that outlives this group, that does the things that are on there, that is responsive to all the various new codes, new procedures, new technologies, new drugs, new advances, and has a thoughtful process that makes decisions about benefit and benefit design going forward. Let me just stop here and see if anybody has any questions about either what we're aimed towards or what the specific charge of this group is.
I would answer that neutrality always means neutrality. So each year we set budget targets, and last year we did a somewhat unprecedented thing and implemented a global cap on Medicaid spending and extended that cap through next year. So the way I would interpret that sentence would be that we have to keep within that cap. So we can't drive us an expense here on a benefit expansion that would drive spending above what we projected for any category that was budgeted under that cap. And I think also that means that we probably are operating under our own sort of pay-as-you-go thinking here, that we should be thinking about creating savings at the same time that we're creating opportunities. And recognizing that some of the things that have been suggested as benefit expansions have been shown to return on those investments, but some of those are not short-term returns. So I would just say that the other thing with neutrality is that we would have to have neutrality within the budget year in which something was actuated.
My only other... maybe addition to this mission is that as you're developing this process moving forward, that there's also an evaluation process built into it, so that as you move forward, you're really able to evaluate on what the return has been and that kind of thing.
In terms of the decisions that are made on benefits?
Yeah, so when we decide on whatever we come up with, how in the future is that going to be evaluated to see whether it was really effective or not?
It's a great point. If I don't think of it, remind the group of that when we talk about the process for going forward and what components should be there, because that is something that I can't even remember if I put that in the as one of the ideas in the process going forward. I remember we talked about it. It's something that is not done very often and is a really interesting and important piece. Any other questions or comments about the charge or the vision? So this is just a reminder to talk about this. There's nothing beyond this. As you know, we gave you a flurry of materials in the past couple of days, and we got some requests from folks to, please try to batch this. Please try to get it to us a little bit earlier. So we'll have four times to do this. Hopefully by the fourth time we'll be a little better. But you got a number of materials, some of them in response to questions that came up previously. Some of them were documents related to today's presentation. I just want to, in no particular order, just let you know what it is that we gave you, and we'll be talking about them as the agenda goes on. You should have gotten a grid that talked about the U.S. Preventive Task Force preventive services that are graded A and B, that also listed our current coverage criteria, as well as what we knew or know from at least one source, which is our HEDIS inquiry rates, what kind of performance we see in New York relative to those preventive services. And when we talk about that in a little bit more detail, talk about what some of the limitations are of that grid. But again, we had some conversation both leading up to the meeting and in the meeting about ensuring that the preventive services that have a good evidence base per the preventive task force, that we think about what our coverage is for that as at least one starting point. And as some of you may know, in federal legislation, there are various kinds of incentives to states to cover with, you know, copay and so on, preventive services that are graded A and B. You also should have gotten a grid. It was, I think, an Excel sheet that went into some detail about the smoking cessation benefit and services, and we can walk through that when we get to it in the agenda. That's information from Medicaid managed care, looking at data on prevalence of smoking, the number of smokers that get various kinds of preventive services, including use of the tobacco cessation benefit and various components of that. You got a couple of pages, which Dr. Hannon, I think, is going to be presenting on, and actually he'll be here probably very soon. I'm talking about angioplasty and PCI. There's some slides on it, but there's also a two-pager that just kind of, in a different format, goes through some of the background of some of the work that he's going to present on. What else? There was a sheet on optional services. You want to talk a little bit about what that is?
Sure. So there was some discussion at the last meeting about optional services and potentially reducing, eliminating optional services. That comes up in the budget context. So we provided just a list by category of the optional services that we cover and the spending for each of those, and a breakout for children and adults, and then a further breakout of adults into those that are dually insured with Medicaid and Medicare. And just a summary on that is that of the $48 billion that we spent in services for federal fiscal year 2010, about 13.8 or 13.9 of that was for optional services. But important to point out that about $4.5 billion of that 13.8 is for prescription drugs.
So I think that's the one document that we don't have specifically in our PowerPoint or in discussion, which is the optional services and the dollar amounts. So this might be, if folks have questions or comments about that, we can do that now, or if you have comments during the agenda that you think of, we can go back to it, but we don't have a specific item for it.
I have just one question. Across the top, it would have been really helpful looking at these numbers, these dollar expenditures, to know the number of enrollees in each of these categories so we could figure out how much we're spending per person.
Yeah, we could do that. It gets a little complicated because we're combining the fee-for-service and the Medicaid managed care, and our unique counts get skewed, but we could try to do something. We may need to break it into managed care and fee-for-service in order to do that. So you're looking for a unique count for each of these categories,
yes,
for that time period.
X number of millions of kids are using this number of,
yep,
service, and this number of non-dual adults are using this number for,
we'll try to we'll try to produce the same table with recipient counts, if that would work.
That would,
okay,
be helpful. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, I have a problem being able to open up that PDF in the zip thing. So do you have any copies of that,
yeah,
available? Because it's,
yeah, there's
oh, okay. I was aware of that.
There's a packet out there, and I assume they still have more copies of all the materials.
Oh, okay.
Can you get one?
I mean, I got,
yep,
I to the email late last night, so there's no one I could talk to
that
about
zip
that.
Zip file thing, right?
Just two questions. So one, do you have a similar breakout of the spend on the required services? Just because that would be helpful, particularly,
yeah,
for context. I think,
yeah, sure.
Looking at the spreadsheet, one of the immediate problems you see is that less than one-third of the spend is in optional services. So that's going to make, if the focus is on interventions or benefit design related to optional services, it still leaves, you know, quite a bit of the spend where we're not really addressing or touching, so it would be interesting to just see
that. Well, interestingly, most of say this in a qualified way and look at Foster as I say it, but I think most of the actionable items that we're actually talking about are sitting in the required federal services, but are potentially proposals to either limit scope or limit based on medical evidence. So even though those services are required by the federal government, if we are able to do utilization review, and we are able to tailor benefit based on medical evidence and medical necessity.
Yes. Okay. So that would just be great to see what the spend breakdown is there. And I agree that getting the proportions of people would be helpful. And then the other question I had is personal care. What exactly does that construct designate?
Personal care is a range of services. They vary in intensity from level one, which is individual assistance for folks for doing, you know, ADLs and activities of living, including things like shopping assistance and stuff like that, all the way up to things that would generally be provided under home health. So it's in home care by personal aid.
And the reason we're smiling is it's a coverage item, a benefit that's gotten a lot of attention over the past years and various kinds of conversations and controversy and so on. So.
I can imagine it would have. I was just asking because it was the second largest item on the list,
and I
didn't understand it.
Did we? I forget. In the first PowerPoint, was there kind of a general count of amounts of what we spend in different categories? I mean, we have that sort of thing.
We'll certainly provide it. We can provide it by category of service, dollars and recipients, and dollars per claim. We can do that for both the mandated services and the optional. We'll give you the recipient counts.
So the other materials that were sent to you, there were a string of, we have an email box in which folks can give us ideas, suggestions, and so on, and we've gotten a number of them. We'll talk about in a little bit detail of what we've received on that. And you've seen the letters, and it's clear that some of them have a lot of support from a lot of folks. So those were sent to you as well and will continue to be sent on to the work group because I think you should see sort of what comes to us and what people want the benefit work group to think about. And the other, and we'll do that in sort of a batched sort of way, or else we'll create this wiki thing, which we said we were going to create last time, which I don't really understand what it is, but somebody much younger and smarter than me does, that will get us out of the box of sending you lots of emails, and you can go to one-stop shopping and see all the materials, right? That's what it is? You're the younger and smarter person, right?
I don't know. Am I either of those things?
Well, you can pronounce it.
But the answer to your question is yes.
Yeah.
It's a place you can go on the web and everybody can get the same material.
And then the other thing that we got yesterday was a series of articles, both from Elizabeth and from Peter, about co-pays, incentives, and deductibles, and so on. And, again, that's for your leisure reading, for backdrop. In the first meeting, there was a conversation about co-pays and deductibles and what role they may play in the Medicaid program and what role they don't play. In response to a conversation Elizabeth and I had about that, I think, you know, what we want the group, particularly early on in this process, is to really, consider all potential options. That is, to not close yourself to any particular way of thinking about benefits or ways to improve benefit design. Ultimately, some of them are going to prove to be great ideas. Some of them are going to prove, for a variety of reasons, not to be great ideas. But I think the reason we've assembled a group of, such bright folks from different parts of the spectrum that bring both content expertise, clinical expertise from doing benefit design, in some cases in the commercial world, in some cases in the Medicaid world, and so on, is that we really want sort of to open the windows, open the door, and get new ideas about how to think about this. So that was sort of the backdrop. And I put Peter on the spot yesterday asking if he wanted to, like, say a few words about those articles. I was mostly kidding, but since he thought I was serious and actually put something together, I thought we should hear a little bit about, at least, Peter, your summary of the articles that you put together on copay and incentives. I think it is helpful.
This will be very briefly.
I just pulled some articles together and sent them to you. Some of them are very good summaries that cite many, many more articles that came out of our work at the fund. I think the DOH staff last week or a couple weeks ago laid out a lot of practical problems with cost sharing in the Medicaid program. And I'll just make a couple quick observations. You know, 60 seconds is not going to end a debate that's been going on for 60 years on utilization and spending and cost sharing, or as a lot of people like to call it lately, skin in the game and all that. The first thing I think is deductibles really have the most impact on spending. You know, in a commercial setting, you can take 30% of the premium out just by having a very high deductible. And that's a pretty much straight transfer of, you know, the services go from covered under your policy to covered by you. I think deductibles are particularly ill-suited for the Medicaid program for obvious reasons. The second thing I'd say is that, you know, cost sharing, it deters both high-value utilization and low-value. I mean, that's been a consensus for, you know, the last 50 years. So in value-based design, you know, that's come about in the past 5 years, they're trying to address that problem. But I think that's really what you get. You'll be deterring, you know, good care that people are receiving as well as the bad care that's not cost-effective or, you know, wouldn't meet the goals of this committee. The third thing I think is the jury is still really out on whether cost-sharing, you know, effectively reduces, you know, overall spending for a couple of reasons, I think. You'll tend to see decreased utilization among your low utilizers anyway, but utilization doesn't change or can even get worse for that small percentage of the people in a pool or a program or a plan that have chronic illnesses that are going to be utilizing care, you know, anyway. They'll just be paying more for it. And you also often see, and some of the literature is cited in what I sent around, you'll see a decrease in some services, but those are offset by an increase in other services, such as ER use or inpatient admissions or what have you. And then finally, you know, cost sharing does fall disproportionately on the chronically ill. And there's a large and growing body of evidence about the sensitivity of very, very low-income people to increases in cost sharing, whether it's a co-premium for a public program that causes disenrollment or utilization patterns that change when cost increases occur. So there's a few articles in that packet as well as some very good ones that Elizabeth sent along that address that issue. Thanks.
Questions or comments about that?
I would just say if what we're doing here is doing a process that's based on evidence, the evidence on this issue has been clear for some time. That's just what it is. Cost sharing really has either a neutral impact or negative impact for the things that we think the healthcare system should do.
So I was remiss in going over a couple of logistics. Let me just do that now. We're going to try to break for lunch around 12:30, 12:45. If you have to take breaks before then, feel free. I know where the men's room is. I couldn't tell you where the ladies' room is, but that way. Okay, men's room is that away. We're slated to go till 3. We'll see what happens with the agenda. If we end early, we end early. We have two more meetings after this. Both of them are up in Albany. Actually, they're in Troy, but October 4th on Tuesday, at the same time, 10:30 to 3. And the last meeting that we have, the fourth meeting, is October 19th from 10:30 to 3, also in Troy. Following that will be, you know, potentially phone calls or email back and forth around the report and around trying to finalize those recommendations. So that's the agenda that we have. As you can tell, it's in pretty rapid sequence and a relatively short time frame to try to do as much as we can to fulfill the charge of the work group. That was it about logistics. Oh, great. I hate when that happens. So, this is our guy. Ron, can you just, like, step out? I think his name is Larry. Larry's our man. I have no idea what the password is. So why don't we go to what we wanted to start with was this draft set of principles for thinking about benefit design. And I think part of that came from a discussion from the first meeting, as well as some email afterwards that Dr. Shaw initiated around trying to put something together that we might be able to look at and agree to relative to principles of thinking about benefit design. And I want to call out all the folks that helped us in this, kind of put this draft together, Scott and Mark and Nirav and Greg and so on. And we wanted to, we had a PowerPoint on it, but even better, I think, is the draft principles sheet, which you should have in front of you. It says Medicaid Basic Benefit Review Work Group Draft Principles, September 8th, 2011. And this is meant, the draft part is meant seriously. I don't think we're anxious to spend 3 hours wordsmithing, but I think we are anxious to review what's on there and get your input about what you think, what makes sense, what doesn't make sense, what you think is omitted that should be in there, what is should come out, and have some discussion about that, which we could then take back and resubmit and get further feedback. So I asked Scott if he would kind of lead the charge on this. So.
Sure. Thank you so much, Foster. And echoing Foster's comments, I'd like to emphasize that this is a draft. It's a starting point rather than a finishing point. And when looking at it, please keep in mind the questions, what is not here that should be here? Or alternatively, what should not be here that is here? And please keep in mind that our goal in doing this is to come up with a very broad measuring stick that we can apply to different services. So the principles ideally should establish a level playing field for evaluation across different provider groups, across different service groups, across different diseases, and also across different stakeholder groups. So with that, I'm simply going to slowly read the principles, and we'll go through them one by one, and I'll indicate principles for which there was unanimity and principles for which the group struggled quite a bit with questions of substance and also wordsmithing. So starting from the beginning, first principle, all Medicaid members will be treated equitably. Second, if Medicaid budgets are insufficient to support all potential services, regardless of evidence or effectiveness, then priorities must be set among services to be provided. Continuing to the third point, priorities in benefit design must maximize the health of the population served by the program and be based on an assessment of benefits, harms, and costs. Now moving to the fourth point, when assessing benefits, harms, and costs, empiric evidence, when available and of high quality, will be critically appraised to determine its appropriateness for policy application and will be given more weight than subjective or expert opinion. And now moving on to the fifth point that has sub-bullets. Criteria to be met for evaluation of specific services and benefits include, first, evidence that it is better than nothing for the population's health. Second, evidence that benefits outweigh harms in improving health. Third, evidence that it is comparatively better or equally efficacious and less expensive than other treatments for the same condition, and access to less expensive interventions does not create undue burden for individuals. Fourth, evidence that it delivers greater benefit for its cost compared to alternative treatments for the same condition. Fifth, the burden of proof for the above criteria lies with those advocating the use of the service. At this point, I'd like to pause and note that there was quite a bit of discussion about whether there should be a qualification for the statement because so many services do not have supporting evidence, and if so, what that qualification would be. Now, continuing on to the next point, cost avoidance through benefit design is legitimate because it supports the ability of the state to provide the maximum number of services that are effective in improving health. Criteria for excluding benefits should focus on those services in which, number one, costs are high and evidence for clinical effectiveness are highly variable or low. Second, evidence of additional value, In other words, benefits to cost compared to other treatments for the same condition is low. And then, getting close to the bottom, criteria for creating conditions for benefit coverage includes those services in which costs are high and documented evidence of adherence to appropriateness criteria for the service is variable or low. And here there was discussion in the group about whether appropriateness criteria should be referred to specifically in this draft of principles. Finally, in the evaluation of services and benefit design, the outcomes of interest should include the preferences of patients, individual autonomy, and those outcomes generally of high value to patients, such as survival, function, symptoms, and quality of life. So I have now read out the initial draft of principles. What I would like to suggest is that we can first take general comments, and secondly, we can go one by one through these principles to elicit particular thoughts about them. Foster, does that sound reasonable to you?
Right.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So with that, I'll open it up to commentary.
I'm curious about, especially in, I guess it's the fifth series of points, why the term evidence-based healthcare is not included. Understanding that the evidence base may not be there for many of the therapies that we're going to be looking at, but nevertheless, I think the emphasis should be on that if the if a thorough review has been conducted, that should be the basis for decision making.
Do you think that the phrase should be explicitly incorporated into what's there, or should it be a separate and new bullet?
It says, right now it says evidence, so you think, are we looking at the same one, the one that says criteria to be met for evaluation? So there are at least three of those four bullets starts with evidence, so you're suggesting that instead of saying evidence, it should be...
Well, I think the way the word evidence is used here is different than the expression, you know, evidence-based healthcare, and clearly it is here, but when it says evidence that is better than nothing for the population's health, I think that's heading in a different direction than the idea if the evidence base exists, that should be at least the first level of I understand it's here. It's we're sort of circling around that, but I'm wondering whether that phrase itself should be included only to eliminate any ambiguity.
Mm-hmm. It's almost as if the first three bullets are discussions of different attributes of evidence-based healthcare.
Right.
So perhaps evidence-based healthcare should be the larger bullet, and then those three bullets describing evidence that it is better, et cetera, should be under the rubric of evidence-based healthcare. Would that satisfy your concern?
So it might say something like, you know, benefits should be... weight should be given to evidence-based healthcare as defined by, and then the following, those first three bullets. Is that, I don't know what you're
I'm good with that, yeah.
Something like that? Okay. Yes?
The second one, if Medicaid budgets are insufficient, priorities, my question is, who sets the priorities?
Right, and so I think the underlying premise of these principles is that these principles would set the priorities. In other words, they would be there as a guide for setting priorities. But that can be made more explicit in the wording. It could say that is the purpose indeed of these principles.
Thank you.
Because not everybody might realize that.
Thank you. Like me, for instance.
Oh, yeah, so many others.
Recently the state passed a rare disease law in the commercial context because many health plans had, there was sort of a problem for people with rare diseases kind of making it through plans, clinical guidelines. And so I think one of the things that we should think about is there are going to be cases. You know, I think we have to think of the sort of the exception to the rule. I mean, in general, I think this makes sense for sort of a generalized rule, but I think we have to sort of acknowledge that a procedure should be established, like the rare disease law statute or some other, whatever it is, external review or some place where someone who can go, who isn't going to necessarily be consistent with the evidence, or for good reasons we might want to deviate in terms of paying for something. And so I think we should have some kind of acknowledgement for some kind of process for an individualized determination in the appropriate case, whether it's a rare disease or, I'm sorry, I'm not a professional physician, so I don't have exactly the right nomenclature, but I do feel that we should have some, I don't want people to write, make an appeal for an aspirin. That's not what I'm talking about. But there may be situations where you have a series of doctors who say that this person should be in this treatment thing, this treatment protocol. This treatment protocol hasn't made it through whatever criteria the super committee who's going to be using these principles has decided. And I think you understand my position. So I guess we should have some kind of acknowledgement that there should be some individualized determination process. I also think perhaps the ADA requires that, and so we might want to just not have a nod to some due process workaround or whatever.
Right. So I guess it's a good point. I think one of the things that we not prepared to talk about today, but maybe could talk, spend some time in a future meeting and or send around, is what exists right now to deal with exactly what you just described. So there are processes right now, some of them in statute, some of them policy within Medicaid, to deal with off-label use, to deal with rare conditions, to deal with experimental drugs and rare, unusual one-offs. So that happens right now. And we've not really woven that process very much into the discussion about benefit design, because it is, as you articulated and as I described, sort of this one-off rare condition thing that we do, that plans do. And that, in fact, is part of the sort of the external appeal process sometimes, is looking at those, the evidence isn't good, or it's experimental, or it's very preliminary, and what do you do? So the question in my mind is whether is how to frame it and whether it belongs in direct principles related to benefit. I think your concern would be that this would be so rigidly applied that there might be conditions.
I think there has to be a sentence acknowledging that the patients have some sort of recourse if they disagree with whatever the outcome of this.
Right. I think as we get into the presentation later, I think we get into Mark's presentation, we'll see how challenged the evidence base is for so many things.
Exactly.
That this is. That scenario is actually not a rare condition at all. It's actually kind of sadly, that's sort of the bread and butter. So.
And I wonder if under the bullet describing burden of proof,
right,
that
that's the part that started
that
getting
would
me
be
anxious.
A time to or a place to call attention to instances in which perhaps a different burden of proof would be appropriate, such as with rare diseases and other situations like that.
I just think an acknowledgement that the benefit, at the end of the day, this is going to affect individual patients.
Yeah.
Individual patients need to, their rights to whatever due process they're entitled to needs to be sort of acknowledged in this document. I'm not talking about a paragraph. I'm talking about a phrase or a sentence here, and I'm happy to draft it when I'm feeling more articulate and not completely rattled by the nurse calling me from school. So,
wonderful. Thank you.
I'd like to see something in here that gets into patient safety and also appropriateness. I mean, what's really striking was with the angioplasty, where you have 12% of the folks inappropriately receiving something, which is an invasive procedure, puts people in harm's way potentially and all that. I think we've got to really put that out there, too, that we're here to make sure that that's not the case.
That, I would say, Scott mentioned that some of these were, we spend more time wordsmithing than others, and probably the having that in mind, that scenario in mind, is sort of what was in my head in the second to last paragraph of, talks about creating criteria for creating conditions for benefit coverage, which creating conditions is kind of vague, but it's about, and the appropriateness criteria is in that. So in that sub-bullet underneath, which Scott mentioned, we had a lot of conversation about, but it was really targeted to think about that, and clearly angioplasty isn't the only procedure around which there's potentially more harm than benefit, particularly if it's applied to individuals around which there's no evidence that it's indicated. So we wouldn't use the word safety, but I would say that the language in that was aimed at trying to get at that. And
is it worth defining what evidence
would be considered appropriate. For instance, if you're looking at a specific chemotherapy that might be experimental or might even be in the early stage of experiments, you'll always find a paper that might say that this is the evidence that this, the transplant and all this entire procedure will work for malignancy A when we know it works for malignancy B and C, or do we want to have some form of accepted national guidelines or some organizational guidelines to say will be the evidence that will be accepted in the benefit design?
So part of what I would respond to that is I don't know the answer to that question. Mark's going to talk a little bit about grades of evidence, and that may help get into this conversation about how precise or specific one should be. I guess the question back to the group would be, do we need a greater level of specificity in describing that in the principles or not? That would be my, on an operational basis, I would say absolutely. Probably anyone who's doing benefit design has to think about gradations or what counts as evidence. And there's things like the external review program has in statute what counts as evidence, for better or for worse. My question back would be for us to consider is how much precision, how much definition, how many pages do we want to put in principles? And I don't know what the answer is, but one possible approach to your question would be to be more precise and to say, here's what we think evidence is, and here's a way in which we rank order that. We would not be able to, probably not appropriate in a list of principles, to say how you operationalize that benefit by benefit when you may have, well, all you have is the lowest grade of evidence.
Well, I was just suggesting maybe putting in some definition that defines at least the minimum level of evidence that would be acceptable, and then you can have a whole criteria set that will define that later on, and it does not need to be spelled out, but just say some form of relatively solid evidence that will be used, and that could be defined later on.
I appreciate that point. I think the three levels of evidence that I think communicate with the practicing physician community are evidence-based healthcare, which is really empiric. Then there is the next legitimate arena of evidence, which is expert opinion panels, et cetera, that have come together to say that that's okay and that's legitimate. And then there's the acceptable standard of care in the community, which is not necessarily backed up by expert opinions necessarily because they haven't been rendered, or empiric evidence, but they're just known to be the right things, the good things to do that actually improve the health of the community and the individuals in it. There's decreasing ability to defend as you go down that tree, but I think the minimum, in my head anyway, would be standard of practice that's accepted by the community at large, which is still very diffuse, but at least it gives us some baseline to work up towards evidence-based medicine from. The additional point I'll make is that I would see this page, which I like myself as one page, as a guiding framework, and once you start defining more deeply and putting more specifics around it, then you're moving into what I would view as the next phase. Let's have a guiding framework, and then do all the worry closet things that are important here as a subsequent piece to a guiding framework.
Yeah, I do think that, you know, all evidence is not the same. And I can imagine situations where there are multiple, considerations for benefits to be covered, and there has to be some comparisons made between, several, all, quote, with evidence. I don't think we have to reinvent the wheel on this, though. Every specialty society now has a framework which really takes what you said, but actually puts it in a numerical schema, grade 1, 2, 3, and 4, or level 1, 2, 3, and 4, and so on. And it would be relatively easy to look at a couple of those and just pick one that you want to, embrace, and that could be sort of an appendix type thing. The second point is, I don't know how the other members of the group feel, but that first bullet, that evidence that it is better than nothing, for some reason, I can't say quite why, it just leaves me feeling a little less than satisfied, perhaps on two levels. Number one, just the wording, and I know we're not supposed to wordsmith. But the second is, I can easily see a very expensive treatment, and I'll make this up, that is, marginally better than doing nothing at all. But then when you do sort of the, you know, the comparisons of, you know, cost and, you know, something which gives you 5% or 2% survival instead of zero, and yet is, you know, extraordinarily expensive, that meets the criteria of being better than nothing, but is it really something that one would want to cover going forward? So I just wonder whether that bullet needs a little bit more thought.
Two comments, one just in terms of a process issue and one of substance, I guess. As written, I think the principals are doing three things. So they're establishing principles such as equity. Two, they're stating that because resources on contingency are scarce, we're going to have some kind of priorities. And the third thing is they implicitly establish a process of prioritization, which is going to be empirical and evidence-driven. So you may want to just consider how do we build out those three things, because there's probably other principles and substance other than equity to consider. We might want to describe something about, you know, just the issue of setting priorities. And the third thing, I do think there's a mixture where we're implicitly stating there's a process of prioritization, kind of describing it but not explicitly calling it out, and that just might be helpful for clarification and communication purposes. I think the second thing, I think the goals of the principles are laudable and being empirical and evidence-driven. But I think if you look at particularly other types of efforts to do things like technology assessment and integrate cost effectiveness into benefit design, they typically run into a couple problems. We've sort of described them here already or touched on them. We may or may not want to address them up front in the principle. So first of all, the vast majority of decisions that we make in medicine, particularly ones with high variance, are gray decisions, which there's varying amounts of evidence. So empirically driven technology assessment often sort of succumbs to that problem. And I think the second problem, which we also touched on, was how do you assess innovation? So those are typically two things that complicate the type of principles that are articulated here in substance.
All great comments. I just want to respond and say, and then get back to you about the three concepts that are here after the meeting, because I think if we can clarify that or make that more explicit, I think that might be helpful, what it is that we're driving at. And as you said, there may be some other things to flesh out in some of those categories. I also think that we tried to put for this meeting kind of a few pieces together that are going to inform each other, and we may be circling back to the principles. So after this, you know, we want to hear a little more about sort of real-life examples, and we'll get into sort of some of that gray, what's black, what's white, some of the challenges. Because I think talking about this in the abstract is very difficult when you get into, so what do we actually know about this? It makes it a little more real. The third part is to talk about the process going forward and how one would do that prioritization, or who would do it, who would set the priorities, or how would that be done exactly. And clearly the principles, the examples, and the process going forward relate to one another. So I'm hoping that we may circle, but, you know, that at some point we'll leave the principles, but I would gather that after we talk about examples and we start talking about process, we're going to circle back to the principles and see what might have been missing, if that makes any sense. Tony?
Yeah, you've done an excellent job with the principles, a really very great degree of fairness and good sense. Facts change over time, and so more evidence accumulates and the conclusions of the evidence therefore change. So one piece that I don't see in here is the longitudinal aspect of it. How changes in our conclusions, changes in recommendations, changes in policy will occur based on this.
So a slightly different point than the point that Paloma made before about evaluation, but this is sort of, is there a process in here that says part of the principle is to go back at this as new evidence emerges and so on? And again, some of that will be in the process and in what we're putting forward or in the process discussion, but I think it may fall into a principle that's important. So, great point.
Just a minor, and it could be a wordsmithing issue as well, and I don't want to do that necessarily, but the first sentence, although I think we're trying to say that we're going to be fair, in relation to what? So it's just, all Medicaid members will be treated equitably. So what does that mean? Does that mean they're all going to be unfairly treated and that's equitable? Or, you know, in relation to what? So probably more words there.
I don't have a ready-made answer for that one, but I get to take the point. Other? So we've kind
kind of done both. Scott laid out a template for let's talk in generalities, and then we'll go point by point. But I think it might make sense, even though we went through a number of the points, just to make sure that just to out any other specific comments we might have going section by section, or if folks have said everything that they want to say about what's on here, then I don't think we need to go through that exercise. What do folks think? Is there anything that we that has not been brought up that people want to bring up around this?
So I would offer that it's directionally correct, and I think you're right that it's going to continue to evolve as we get into other discussions, but it would seem like it's appropriate, in my view, to move on.
It's a really good effort, but can I beg people to try to use real simple language and simple sentence construction? Because it's kind of complex. I mean, the issue is complex to start with, and when the language is complex as well, it makes it harder for people around the table to actually understand what we're talking about. So I just beg you for simplicity.
You don't, clearly don't understand the purpose of obfuscation. Okay, so what we commit to, I think we'll probably get other comments on this or things that inform this. What we commit to doing is taking back the comments that we heard today and trying to do another draft and start doing.
One little process question. Are we going to post this on our like subcommittee website for the public to comment on?
Pretty sure it is posted.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I think all the documents have been posted.
I admit I haven't been there for about a week.
Neither have I, but I believe all the things we've been distributing have been posted. Do you know, Greg?
No.
And there is a public open line to this meeting, and the open meetings themselves are public as well, just so,
yeah,
so that you know. And there's the email, as I mentioned, to get public comments, which we have done.
I just think that since this is a principal document, it sort of seems it should be kind of prominent, as opposed there's a lot of, I mean, we've received several, you know, we've this much material already, and I'd hate for this just to be in a bundle of stuff.
Right. So folks can see it as a work in progress.
Just the agenda and PowerPoint?
Okay. So, again, you know, for this group, is do we want the work in progress to be posted or not? I guess there's some pluses and minuses to it. It's going to change, you know, in a week or so. But the bullet points are there. Any other comments? Any other comments on the charge? I mean, I'm sorry, on the principles? So, may rely on the same usual suspects who were foolish enough to volunteer the first time to work on this, but we also, if you want to, we would probably circulate the draft more generally to everybody, so feel free. Restate the next part of this presentation is really to try to go from, you know, 10,000 feet to what are folks actually doing around benefit design? What are other states doing? From the experience of OHSU and the programs that they have run to help states make these decisions, what has been some of the guiding principles and ways of thinking about evidence and making these decisions, as well as what are some of the specific opportunities that other states around the country have been useful to look at for things that potentially fall into areas where there's questions about benefit and harm, benefit and burden. Mark's going to present some after taking an initial peek at some of our own data, but I assume, Mark, you'll say this, but I'll say it as well, that some of the numbers and the ideas on here are very much preliminary just to get us thinking about them. It's not specific projects or areas that we've landed on, but really to supplement some of what we've some of the other information that we've gotten through the website and so on about things to add. This is really a description primarily of things to think about in terms of potential overuse or misuse for the most part. Is that fair, Mark? But I also thought, you know, we should start the conversation about approaches to thinking about evaluation technology and new services and so on, because it's something that we know a little bit about. So, Mark, I'm going to turn it over to you, and if you want to trade places and come up here and work this.
And I can advance my own.
morning, everybody. Sound check. We're doing okay out there? Okay. I want to, before I start, just give credit to our colleagues at SUNY who actually worked with us on putting this presentation together. And what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about some experience we've had working with a set of states who participate in an evidence-gathering project that we staff. And I think just to reinforce what Foster said, the examples that I'll use here are examples that may be useful in a big as-you-go scenario as you're looking to work within a constrained Medicaid budget to make sure that you're getting additional services that are effective out to the patients in your Medicaid program. There may be some opportunities for savings that could be useful in garnering resources for additional services that are more effective. So I'm just going to walk through a quick overview of the research process that these states use together, and that consists of defining the questions, searching the literature, appraising the literature, and synthesizing the evidence, and then peer review. So the states start out with a process called PICO Plus. So that's population intervention comparator outcome, and we add on policy context and analysis and cost effectiveness when it's requested by the states. So as you can see, there's quite a bit of time spent working around defining the questions that the policymakers want to research. When we first started this project, in some cases policymakers would come in and they would say something like, tell us what the evidence shows about treating low back pain. And that's not really a researchable question. It's far too broad. And so part of the exercise we go through here is to get folks to make sure that they are clearly defining the population that we want to look at, the intervention, the comparators that are being that are important, and then the outcomes. Let me say that the states that are involved in this project uniformly prefer health outcomes to surrogate indicators. So when we're looking at the outcomes, the first line that they're looking at will be changes in mortality, will be health changes that a patient can recognize and experience, as opposed to a lab metric such as cholesterol readings or blood glucose levels in diabetics. So what they're really looking for is evidence that this has an impact on health. There are a number of search strategies that we use, and the most inclusive is all relevant literature. This is what's typically used in what's called a systematic review. I apologize to the clinicians for whom some of this will be really redundant, but just to make sure you understand how these states have come to the conclusions they've reached, I think it's important. In many cases, the states are using existing systematic reviews as a foundation point for their policy decisions. And in these systematic reviews, it's usual that all the major databases are searched, the databases that catalog clinical research are searched, that potentially relevant research and evidence is brought together, is gathered, and then they even go to the measures of hand-searching the bibliographies of relevant studies in order to make sure that they haven't missed anything that could be relevant to their decision-making. The problem with systematic reviews, however, is that they take a long, long time. They can take up to a year and a half to 2 years, and they're very expensive. There are some that have cost in excess of over $250,000 to do, and so there's a limit to what the states can actually do on their own motion relative to systematic reviews. They can use those that are existing, and they can update them, or they can find other partners, such as the Agency for Healthcare Quality and research and quality at the federal level to help sponsor systematic reviews that they think need to be done. They also have some more limited research strategies. So one of the more obvious ones is just to use English-only research, but then also using a set of core sources that have been pre-screened for quality. So the Cochrane Collaboration is a great example of a place where there are registries of trials and systematic reviews that can be accessed readily so that you can be sure that you're getting most of the really important information together on a particular subject. So this depends on the subject at hand, and you know whether or not they actually go to core sources or use more unlimited look at the literature. It depends on the subject, the time that's available for reaching a decision, because policymakers sometimes, you know, not making a decision is making a decision, and so they may need quicker turnaround than is possible with a full systematic review. The way research sources that they shy away from are things like the most cited research or the most recent research. So what they're looking for is not the most popular research, but the most valid and well-done research. And not the most recent research, because quite often there are a lot of studies that that need to be considered along with the most recent research to get the full picture of what's taking place. Praising the literature, the hierarchy of evidence the states use in their reviews are starting out with meta-analyses of randomized controlled trials or systematic reviews of randomized controlled trials. So when those are available, they like to use them. And if they are getting outdated, then they like to update them and use them as a core underlying piece of analysis. Individual randomized controlled trials, and then on down to observational studies, cross-sectional cohort case control studies, for example, and then basic science research and clinical experience. There was some mention of guidelines earlier, or the work that specialty societies have been doing around guidelines. Just as one randomized controlled trial, when you've seen one randomized controlled trial, you've only seen one, and they vary in quality and thoroughness, the same can be said for guidelines. So there are now some internationally recognized methods for reviewing guidelines so that we can evaluate whether or not they actually comport with the evidence that exists on a given subject.
Mark, can you go back? Can you show that slide for just a second? I have a question.
Yep. Foster. Sorry.
Go back.
If you can. Oh, let me see if I can. Oh, you may have outstripped my
previous. There you go.
Where are we? All right.
Previous.
Okay, sorry. Got it.
So I guess question back to Arnie. So is this the kind of description of evidence that you were talking about? And question to Bill, is number six on this list? Bill Gillespie, it's number six on this list of appraising, take off the appraising literature, but thinking about evidence, would six down be the community standard in some sort of gradation of evidence?
Well, to answer your question, yes, this is what I meant. And I would comment on the community standard, but I guess I'm not so sure community standard it would be an acceptable evidence. Because many, if you ask a cardiologist about angioplasty, you'll get a very different opinion than if you look at evidence-based outcomes. So I'm not so sure community standards would fit into this when you're dealing with such a large population and large budget.
And Bill, do you see it on this, or is it in a different kind of framework, thinking about the three categories that you mentioned?
Right. So I think where there would be evidence, i.e., cardiologists who understand what the right approach should be for a particular intervention, that's expert opinion, which comes above acceptable community standard. I think clinical experience is a phrase gets at the notion I'm trying to get at, which is there's a lot of clinical experience that has enough weight of time behind it that has not been challenged well enough by either empiric evidence or expert opinion. And there are a lot of decisions and a lot of benefits that fall into that category, and we need to have something from which we're saying it's okay to be providing those things, as opposed to saying if there's no evidence associated with this, then we really can't put the state at risk for providing for those services and paying for them.
I think, like, to that point, well, I get really leery about, like, when you get into community standards, because if you look at the Dartmouth Atlas, you go to one community and doing the angioplasties up in northwestern Ohio was the thing to do, and they had, like, four times the rate of everybody else's. So it gets to be a real swamp you want to get into. I think the guidelines, though, there are national guidelines that come out of NIH that use a lot of the items that are in 1, 2, and 3 in their development. And I really wouldn't want to, I kind of discount their value. But, again, if it's in an area like where there isn't any of the first five, yeah, I understand. But I would really I not want to discount the nationally developed ones through NIH and the various other really well-recognized groups out there. But to develop your own and you're standing out there by yourself, then I don't really buy into that too much that way.
Yeah, so I was trying to figure out a way whether some of our conversation before and this notion about expert opinion belongs on a hierarchy, and trying to get at whether we actually have any consensus or agree that this represents an appropriate hierarchy of evidence, and whether since guidelines, I think, Joe, as you point out, really kind of cuts across some of those. I'm not sure that guidelines is what I would put in the hierarchy of evidence, but number six could be guidelines based on expert opinion, or primarily based on expert opinion, which I think, Mark, is what you were getting at in terms of the variation, in terms of the quality of guidelines. There clearly are some guidelines that are based on 1, 2, or 3 or some mix of that, and then there are guidelines or recommendations from professional societies that are expert opinion that may reflect community standard. So I'm just putting out there whether in thinking about the hierarchy, whether we should think about that as a number six down the list, that is expert opinion based guidelines or consensus statements or something, or does it belong on this list or not?
So for the body of benefits for which you can find no empiric evidence based guidelines and no expert based guidelines, and we know that we have technical as well as clinical judgment variation all over the country, as the Dartmouth Atlas says, what would we do with regard to having a framework within which to evaluate those as benefit opportunities?
I'm looking at, and we'll get to it when we get to the process and the how-to, something in which the process that we use to make decisions actually says specifically what the nature of the evidence is it's based on, and does it in some kind of ranking or categorization order, just like, as was said by others, professional societies do that routinely, the U.S. Preventive Task Force does that, and so on, but develop a nomenclature and a way of deciding, what's the best evidence and what's the gradations, and people can decide for themselves, and I think as find a lot of the evidence is kind of in that, not necessarily in 1 or 2 range for lots of things, right?
One quick comment on the slide. I think it depends on what we're talking about, because we've been talking about appraising the evidence, and the slide is appraising the literature. Those are slightly different things. So if it's appraising the evidence, then you treat guidelines differently versus what you do to appraise the literature. That's just something to consider for the sake of clarity, because they're different conceptually. The other thing is, I think it's sort of I touched on this before, but the vast majority of decisions one makes are gray decisions. So I think this is something, especially a technology assessment and these types of efforts, generally don't acknowledge often, but we might as well either come to some kind of consensus on what we want to do, because much of medical work involves tacit knowledge. It's not made explicit. You can't really make it explicit. So this is, I just bring it up because it's an inherent difficulty. It's not like we're going to solve the problem, but it's the nature of knowledge work, and you see it across industries.
I apologize if including guidelines on here created confusion. It's not that guidelines are less valuable in appraising research, because oftentimes the national guidelines that were mentioned are great examples of places where really top quality folks have gotten out there and have critically appraised the research and then applied those into recommendations for practice. So they can be very useful to policymakers. The only reason I put it on here is because
When you've seen one guideline, you've seen one, and you've seen only one, and they do vary in quality from very rigorous to what Andy Oxman from the Cochrane Collaboration calls gobsat, which is good old boys sitting around talking turkey. So I think that they should be seen. The other thing I think that's always difficult in deliberations such as this is separation of clinical practice from policymaking, clinical practice from a payment policy. And so it's hard not to conflate those things as we try to wrestle with how we're going to use the evidence. And what these states have, the way in which these states have used the evidence is not necessarily to direct practice in any way, but to establish their payment policies for their Medicaid programs. So I think there's a subtle difference there, but an important one to keep in mind. Okay. So in synthesizing the evidence, it runs the gamut from summarizing good quality evidence results to a meta-analysis of good quality and similar results and grading the overall strength of evidence, which I want to talk about just a little bit more. Here is some examples of what in the grade, which this is an international internationally developed and recognized ranking set of criteria, and there's a methods manual for grade that can take folks through the process of evaluating clinical evidence. And so I use this as one example, and I think it's an important example because what's used by AHRQ, what's used by ECRI, to perhaps a little less extent, but still very similar extent, this really does form the foundation for what's used by Hayes Incorporated and others. So this is kind of a touchstone, and there are subtle differences between the methods that each one of these organizations use, but they are pretty similar to, grade in many ways. So I'll just use this as an example. So high-quality evidence would be randomized trials or a number of randomized trials showing a similar result or systematic review or meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials. And this is from the standpoint of showing us what works and doesn't work in a particular clinical intervention. Moderate-quality evidence would be a single trial or trials or systematic reviews with minor or what are called non-fatal flaws in the grade methodology. There are critical pieces that have to be included for something to be considered good or moderate quality evidence, considered good quality evidence, and then there are others where there's a little more equivocation around what their importance. And so there can be non-fatal flaws, so you would like to have certain questions answered that aren't in the particular study, but you can still have moderate quality evidence with those non-fatal flaws. Then low-quality evidence, which generally includes observational studies, and then very low-quality evidence down to expert opinion. The one thing I want to say about this is observational studies can actually move their way up into the moderate category by virtue of a number of different qualities. So, for example, you may have some good-quality prospective observational studies that show a very high benefit, a very high level of benefit, or a very strong dose-response relationship, there are a number of other critical factors as you look at observational studies that can actually move them up into a higher level of evidence. So it's not that all observational studies are absolutely low quality, but they sort of start out there, and if they have certain qualities, they can move up to be considered stronger evidence. Similarly, randomized controlled trials and systematic reviews can be badly done, and they can come down to low-quality evidence very very easily if they're badly done, if there are apparent biases in them or fatal methodological flaws. So this is just kind of I hate to use the term, but these are sort of principles of where the study designs.
I would just urge some caution. I really would, because quite frankly, I think we've all, the clinicians in the room certainly have seen
situations where a single trial, which would get, you know, a three-star rating on this schema, turned out to be extremely misleading. And while, you know, I'll acknowledge this GOBSAT acronym, I think many would feel that in a properly convened, you know, non-conflicted forum where acknowledged national or international experts get together and really talk about, you know, in an earnest and open way about their opinion on something where there may not really be any evidence, you know, that may wind up being far better than, you know, a single trial or observational studies and so on. I don't know that we have to belabor it, but I just want to say that there is no magic bullet to how you lay this out, and I think there are pluses and minuses to any hierarchy that one proposes.
Point well taken. I include this just to give you an idea of what sort of the criteria that most of the rankings for clinical evidence are using at this point in time
and
where they place those elements.
Henry, before you go, was there somebody on the phone trying to get in?
Somebody on the phone that wanted to comment?
Mark, this is Henry. I really like the way you laid it out. This is a very standard, a well-appreciated approach. The only thing I wanted to say is that given the population that we're working with in terms of the Medicaid population, where there's high need, lots of variability, vulnerable populations, does your thought about the quality of observational studies increase, particularly around areas where we're talking about utility, uptake, effectiveness, and the like? That's just my own general perspective, is that, you know, a lot of times we do RCTs, and RCTs, of course, are the gold standards, but it's rare that rare, not impossible, that we get really the kind of populations that we work with in the Medicaid side. So in my own view, where you have observational studies that are fairly well done, and you have the right target population, they tend to move up in my mind in terms of quality for making certain judgments.
Yeah, it's a great comment. I think the one of the real tensions, especially for, let me just start by saying, whenever the states authorize a study, one of the things that they always want to look at is if the evidence demonstrates any differences among subpopulations. And I think that's at the heart of your question. And as you say, in many cases, there aren't those kinds of data available from what we tend to think of as higher quality evidence. And so there is a real tension around trying to figure out when an observational study includes an important population and whether or not the quality of that study yields results that can be actually depended upon. And I think that is really a challenge for folks that are making Medicaid policy. The one other thing, I think there's a small axiom that goes along with this, that that the policymakers that participate in this process always keep in mind, and that is the evidence is essential, but it's not sufficient. And judgment is always required. And so when you look at this, it gives you a way to begin to think in a structured way about how you're going to use the research that's available to inform your decisions, but it doesn't dictate the policy. That requires judgment. That requires you to take into account these other factors. So it doesn't create, you know, a crystal clear answer every time, but it can be helpful.
Mark, the other thing that I would say, you may be getting to in a later slide, is that there's sort of a working presumption in thinking about this model that the answers or the conclusions are the same. And the reality is that high-quality studies can differ with each other. So not the other nuance and the other challenge is that evidence doesn't always have arrows going in the same direction. And so that creates the process is the evidence is necessary but insufficient also because it doesn't always tell you exactly what the answer is. Well-designed studies can come up with very different conclusions, right?
Right, they can. And one of the advantages to a well-done systematic review is that it can take that conflicting information and by virtue of analyzing the relative quality of the studies, analyzing the methods, it can sometimes actually
find the reason for differences, and you can take that into account in your decision making. Anything else on this slide?
I was just going to quickly, this is, I think, a very well-accepted hierarchy for evidence, and I think that works for our purposes. Just two things, comments. Just Category 3, just in the near-term to long-term future, is going to explode. So if you look at sort of a lot of things happening in healthcare, particularly the development of infrastructure, it's going to be observational studies, which are going to become the overwhelming source of some kind of data in healthcare. And they're frequently going to involve methods that fall outside of biostatistics, statistics, and econometrics. So that's going to, I think, create significant challenges just in terms of assessing the evidence. I think the second thing is this hierarchy is really a prioritization of internal validity of the evidence. And in general, when you're trying to do benefits, the real problem is external validity. So some kind of criteria or some kind of hierarchy with regard to that would probably be helpful as well.
Can you say more about that? About the external validity and what the...
Yeah, when we're evaluating evidence, there's generally sort of two axes you can do it on. Right? So the first is internal validity, and if something isn't internally valid, it's really not going to be of any use whatsoever, so we tend to do that. So randomized control trials, their impact really is you take two groups. You can basically, if you can't measure a variable, you assume just by randomization that the two groups are equivalent. Right? So what that means is that you can isolate the impact of the intervention regardless of the population and its context. That's really the goal. But when you're trying to actually utilize evidence, and this is the problem clinically we face all the time, is how do you then map that, what's internally valid in the context and circumstances of a particular study or trial, to something which is context sensitive. So the whole goal of much of this axis is to strip away context. Right? You want to essentially remove all variance in different kinds of applications, but in practice, both at the policy level and clinically, you can't strip away context.
So it's partly Henry's point about population as well as the other factors, not only the individual population, but the actual setting, the payment, the delivery system.
Yeah, all of these things, yeah. So if he was more specific, I'm sort of trying to make a general point, I guess. But this is, it's nothing to do with this. It's just a general problem we have in medicine and healthcare.
So I think, just to tee up, I think that that may be a way of thinking about, I hadn't thought about it, but maybe a way of thinking about some of the other things we're going to talk about in terms of the evidence, you know, for one, for preventive services or for tobacco cessation, and what actually happens in the real world. I think it raises that, as you put it, the external validity issues, or it raises implementation issues about benefit, or it raises payment issues, or it raises real-world features about you have a benefit, here's what it is, it looks pretty good, but here's what happens in the real world.
Yeah, assessing internal validity, I think we have a very well-defined set of methods to do that now, and I think Mark summarized these very well. The sticky part of the problem we always encounter is that problem of how do you generalize from internally valid findings, and that's where things become very difficult. That's where gray decisions enter. That's where the world becomes very contextual.
There's two contexts. One is in the clinical realm, how you translate it, and the other is in a benefit realm, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, for instance, Mark was describing states like to use outcomes, right? Outcomes are great, but they don't actually map to what the construct of a benefit is. Right? You're not providing a benefit to an outcome. You can incentivize certain outcomes to benefit structure, but the benefit itself in substance is not directly related to an outcome. It's related to some kind of provisioning of services. Now, we can sort of change payment models, et cetera, to redefine what the construct looks like, but in general, there's the corollary is between the benefit and some delivery of a service.
Well, I think one of the other things is that you can have elegant studies that are randomized controlled trials that are in an academic setting, but when you try to apply it into the real world setting, all bets could be off. I mean, based upon externalities, you have absolutely no control over. So that's where I think, again, getting back to the observational studies, I think when you're looking at populations and what happens to them, like if you have someone that's isolated and you can control everything around them, an intervention might work just fine, but if you put them in a situation where they've got tremendous social economic barriers to be able to really concentrate on things, then things can really not look as good. And you know, I think it's really like part of the reality check in terms of what goes on with a lot of things we look at, and like particularly with technology evaluation. If you can do it outside of an academic setting and it still, I say, holds true, then I think there's a lot of value to something like that.
I'm sorry to keep jumping in, but this also tracks back, I think, Paloma, to your comment before about evaluation, so that partly, you know, the evaluation of actually what happens post-benefit is an evaluation of that X, you know, in some ways is at least evaluating, not evaluating external validity, but it's evaluating at least the external factors that are going to then impact on that potentially high-quality evidence-based benefit. But, you know, stuff happens, right? And the importance of sort of being able to actually find out what happens and why is important in thinking about the benefit going forward.
That's a really important discussion, and I think just to go back over a couple of the highlights from because it was fairly wide-ranging, but for folks that don't do this stuff all the time, the difference between internal and external validity has to do with when you're talking about internal validity, you're trying to figure out if in the best possible circumstances something works or doesn't, I think is the way to think about that. And external validity is whether or not that thing works or doesn't can be generalized into the real world. Is that a fair summation of?
Just to give a concrete example, though, that comes up in practice all the time. There's many guidelines on how we should use anticoagulation in different populations, right? But in practice, the populations that you see are the people most likely to benefit from different kinds of anticoagulations, like Coumadin in the past, et cetera, don't ever map to the studies, or rarely do. So one of the reasons why, in practice, anticoagulation is, in terms of quality of care, looks so poor compared to standards, is that the studies themselves don't readily generalize. So the external validity of them tends to be very poor. So that's just a concrete example of the difference.
Foster, may I make a suggestion thinking about time? There's a lot of controversy over different level of evidence scales, primarily because of this very issue of internal validity versus external validity. One way to incorporate the concerns we've been discussing now would simply be to have asterisks next to low quality and moderate quality, with the explicit provision that if an observational study appears to have great external validity, in other words, it's in the population that we're concerned about, that may trump a study with quote-unquote moderate quality if that study with moderate quality doesn't have great external validity because it's on a very different population. That would be a simpler way of explicitly taking into account this discussion we've just had without proposing a whole other dimension of evidence evaluation, which is something that I've done in certain papers, but it may not suit the purposes of this group well because it might make it too complicated.
I think that's a good suggestion. We'll take that.
Take the phone to listen.
Okay. Is there a comment on the phone?
Okay. All right, so the score number Cassie for Saturday, right?
I'm sorry, could you say who you are and then go ahead with your comment, please?
He said, oh, I'd love to come to something like that.
I'm sorry, who's speaking?
Not for this kind of thing. Can I have a sense of humor?
I didn't get any of that. You're dialed into a work group on benefit design for New York State Department of Health. Is that the call that you believe that you're on?
Okay.
It wasn't me, Foster.
It didn't sound like you at all.
Okay, we'll continue.
Ask folks to put themselves on mute if you're not specifically responding to a question or trying to make a comment.
Oh, yeah, I cannot. Should we call him and his wife, or what do you think?
I think we may need, what's his name again, and see if he can mute the lines. There's only a couple lines that are open. I think it's the commissioners and Kathy's.
Okay. Is it okay to go ahead?
Yeah.
Okay. What does all this mean, actually? This is another part of the great approach that a way of thinking about how high-quality evidence may affect our thinking or the level of confidence we can have in it, and so on. So you can see that if we have high-quality evidence, it's very unlikely that additional evidence or additional research would change the estimate of the effect of the intervention or our confidence in that estimate. So when we get to the level of having high-quality evidence, it's unlikely that additional research would change that. In moderate quality, it's likely to have an impact on our confidence in the estimate of effect, and it may change the estimate.
No worries.
And low quality, additional research is likely to have an impact on our confidence in the estimate of effect and is likely to change the estimate. And when you get to very low, any estimate of effect is very uncertain. So the grade, that's kind of the way the grade process summarizes the effect of the different levels of evidence. We also do peer review for the states that are involved in this project, also do peer review of their reports, either by selected experts or by open review, whereby they post the reports and ask for just open comments so that they get the broadest cross-section. It depends on the report and the amount of time they have to get to the results that they need for their policy making. So how they use the evidence very quickly. Missouri, I'll use a high-tech imaging example in Missouri. One of the possibilities that we'll discuss is using prior authorization for certain interventions. And in Missouri, they used a prior authorization process for high-tech imaging based on research around when it was appropriate to do CT scans of the thorax, head, and so on and so forth. And actually there with a prior authorization process, they were able to flatten their trend line so that they were seeing really rapid growth in high-tech imaging expenditures in Medicaid, they were actually able to bring those down to pretty much a steady state. In Oklahoma, there was a legislative initiative to mandate that Medicaid provide coverage for tributyline pumps to be used for prevention of preterm labor, and the Oklahoma Department of Health utilized the evidence in conversations with their legislators to show that this wasn't a good idea, there were significant risks and no benefits to using tributyline pumps. And so they used the evidence in the legislative process to keep from being mandated to provide a service. In Alabama, they used the evidence in a number of maternity care issues, stretching from whether or not to use a certain type of birth control method to evidence around best interventions for women with substance abuse problems who are pregnant, and a number of other cases. In Washington, they're a unique example. They're probably farther down the road than almost any other state in terms of using evidence to inform their health, coverage decisions, and what they provide through state benefits. They have their own health technology group that does health technology assessments, and then the results of those assessments are part of for not only Medicaid, but also workers' compensation and employee health benefits and the subsidized health plans for the state of Washington. So they use really, they have a very robust
health technology assessment process and a very direct translation to policy through state statute. Their Medicaid medical director there has also initiated a process of when a new request for a new service is brought to Medicaid, he sends the party that's requesting to supply the service to the state a dossier form and asks them to supply the evidence they have that their intervention actually works, that its benefits exceed harms, and so on. And then that's what he uses for a baseline for further reviewing the potential intervention. And in Minnesota, this is another high-tech imaging example, but there, rather than using prior authorization, they used a decision support process done through a broad stakeholder participation in terms of developing community standards of care based on the evidence. So what they did was they took the evidence base, brought it into a community process, and said, we're going to make an explicit community standard of care based on this evidence, and then we will put that into our decision support systems for the physicians that work in our managed care plans. And so they that's another way in which the evidence can be used. Now I want to talk just briefly about a few examples that could be considered as areas where some coverage decision changes or coverage policy changes could increase the revenue that the state has for more effective services. The classification here is a never event, which means that this particular intervention just shouldn't be covered. And then under automatic coverage limitation, there's a never event for certain populations. So under automatic coverage limitations, we're talking about setting up edits within a payment system where if the event is connected with a certain population, then it becomes a never event, or there are quantity or frequency limitations that could be put into the coverage decisions. And then finally, prior authorization. The one thing that we don't have in these examples is coverage with evidence development, and just I'll mention this just in passing because there's a great example that's just been recently publicized. It's the cerebral artery stenting process that a very recent study came out on, where this was something that was approved by the FDA for use with additional evidence.
The leader has turned lecture on, and your line will remain muted until the conference leader unmutes your line.
It was important that this be taken out of the usual practice for stroke treatment. So coverage with evidence development is another possibility. It's a little more complex. But it's actually becoming something that more and more folks are thinking about. CMS actually did another project on lung reduction surgery where they did coverage with evidence development and actually came up with a very limited set of criterion for doing that. So there are good examples of where that may be useful.
Quick comment. I think we'd all agree with the concept that you laid out, particularly the idea that there are certain things that just should never be covered. I would just wonder whether the term never event is the right term, since it obviously has a very distinct meaning in the healthcare, particularly the safety community. And I can imagine a lot of confusion. We should call it something, but maybe something.
Right. That's a great point. And for those of you who aren't familiar with it, the term never event actually has to do with medical errors. And it's something like cutting off the wrong leg in surgery. So we should probably correct the lexicon. I appreciate that. That's a good idea. You have a couple of tables that will give you a summary of the topics. I want to just walk through them very quickly. So interventions for chronic low back pain, there are a set of interventions for chronic low back pain. And this will give you an idea of sort of the way in which the states have structured their reports. There will be an overview. There will be some indication of the prevalence. If it's available, we'll give prevalence for the state for each state that's involved. And then we look at the evidence
and we'll give an evidence summary. Now, these are going to be really, really paraphrased, drastically paraphrased. But when you look at prolotherapy, interdiscal steroid injection, facet joint steroid injection, systemic corticosteroids, or traction, continuous or intermittent, there's really no evidence to support, there's no good quality evidence of efficacy for those in treating low back pain. And in addition to that, there's evidence around advanced imaging. There's usually, for a large majority of cases, there's really no advantage in terms of clinical outcomes to using advanced images, with exceptions of red flag situations where there's a certain set of criteria where it's actually indicated can result in better outcomes.
Right. Good question. How do you distinguish between situations in which there is a certain procedure hasn't been studied and a situation in which a procedure has been studied and the evidence shows that it has no effectiveness? Because they can be very different situations from the standpoint of making recommendations. And then the second question is, I noticed that you explicitly this framework explicitly endorses prior authorization as a method of utilization control, but there are arguments that that's a very inefficient way of controlling utilization, and there indeed are other alternative approaches for controlling utilization.
Right. This wasn't meant to be a full catalog of all the ways in which you can control inappropriate utilization. Prior authorization is one of the options that is commonly considered. There are arguments pro and con, and so this doesn't, it says this is a possible thing to consider. So all of these are meant to be a discussion that wherein you could consider using one of these strategies for limiting inappropriate utilization. Can I just say one other thing in response to that, and then I'll come right back to you. The folks that are in these states are increasingly wary of things that haven't been studied. So in answer to your first question, they are sort of, I mean, they're not, Missouri's one of them, but they're not all from Missouri, and they're all in sort of the show me state, mentality regarding, if you've got something that sounds like a good idea, that's great. We want to see the evidence. I'm sorry.
That's exactly what I just wanted to understand.
Yeah.
It isn't entirely clear what this the chart is.
Yep.
It a summary of examples of procedures that have been, you know, from all over the country that you compiled just to show us how our own technology, if we decide to go, I mean, I'm sort of having a hard time following our conversation because I know in the last time in the PowerPoint we talked about how we have an existing committee with you three medical directors, and I assume one of them is you, and the Department of Health does something, reviews stuff, and the CPT codes is too much, and you don't have enough staff and all that stuff. And so this is an example of the kinds of different items that could be reviewed, and, you know,
yep.
In some states they use prior approval, in some states
right.
They do full-on coverage limitations, and probably the list of the other, these five states have these committees that do coverage limitations.
Right.
And so maybe I'm too eager to know the end of the story,
yep.
But I think it's sort of, I'm kind of struggling between how this fits with what we're doing in New York. Are these all procedures that have been considered in New York, or?
That's what I was going to try to answer.
Yeah.
So, and we spent a lot of back and forth trying to frame what this is to not confuse you.
I mean, maybe I'm the only one that's sort of lost here.
Yeah, probably not.
Yeah.
So these examples are, asked Mark to put in specific examples so that we got out of the stratosphere and out of principles into real life. These are examples, as you said, sort of culled both from what nationally folks are looking at, both public and private payers, as well as potential things for New York to look at as well. And really wanted him to sort of go through kind of this notion of how we might start to think about this. And I think as we go down, we have further conversations, how we actually prioritize which are the ones that sort of are worth this sort of investment of review and which ones are not. So
can you ask us to go along which ones we can do in New York? I don't have that slide that's on the chart.
We can do that. I also just want to remind everybody of the end product. At the end of this,
the end of the
At the end of this, I think the goal is to walk away with essentially two basic products. One is a process by which to do ongoing assessment of the benefit against evidence. And I think that's, you know, where the principles are starting and where we're beginning the discussion. The other is a set of concrete recommendations that we could make for benefit changes that could be considered by the fuller MRT. So I think the examples we were hoping would be helpful from two lenses. One is a way to look at evidence against practice for the perspective of bringing the principles to life in that ongoing process that may come from this group. And then second, some how does this cross over to what we pay for in Medicaid? And we'd hope maybe you'd ask us some of those questions.
Well, just to follow up to that, I mean, then a lot of, maybe we need to let the public know that, because there are people submitting, you know, specific benefit proposals that they want this group to address. And I, for one, feel a little uncomfortable that we're completely disregarding that. And instead, what we're really working on is a process for making, for some entity down the pike to be able to make the judgment calls about these proposals. So, you know,
let me try to. I don't think that's off the table. Okay, and we're going to talk a little bit about some of those ideas today as well. The way I would try to re-say what Greg said, which is that we're hoping at the end of this line that we have a set of benefits that we want to focus on that we should put the accelerator to in some fashion. Those could include new benefits as well as existing benefits that we think are high value, and some help with thinking about how we design the benefit package so that high value benefits get used more often or get added. At the same time, we want some help in thinking about things we should put the brake on, and those would be things at the other end of the spectrum, low value, high cost, and how we, whether it's eliminating, whether it's any of the various tools, whether it's prior auth or something more elegant, and how to focus on and some set of what those might be, if only in part to offset and deal with the budget neutrality thing, which I mentioned earlier. The third part is the vast gray in the middle, which is probably 90% of, you know, of it. And it's a process, a set of principles and a process for how to actually deal with the vast middle, which is neither in the clearly high value underused category or, you know, from 20 paces no value, we should, it's a quote unquote never event or something we should just restrict like crazy. So I think that, so it's identifying the two extremes and helping with the process for how we deal with the vast middle, both the vast middle now and the vast middle going forward. So new proposals, and I mean, folks are coming up with things around benefits that they're bringing to this group, whether it's new ideas about how to structure the benefit or specific new benefits. That's all fine, and it's grist for the mill and appropriate for this group. I don't know if there's any other group that it's appropriate for. But again, it, as we'll talk about later, it gives an example of how challenging this is because, you know, generally speaking, folks are much better at coming up with things to add than things to subtract. And usually when they want to subtract something, it's from your neighborhood, not my neighborhood, right? That's the way this game is played. So, you know, we need help with that dynamic going forward so that we can be sure that our benefit package is paying for the right things as much as possible. Does that help?
Yes.
So try not to get too stuck on these specific examples. They really are just kind of throwing some things out there. They're the counterbalance to the things we might want to talk about adding and so on, and things that are potentially underused. Going through both the nomenclature and the process that has been used to try to evaluate these things. Some of them have some salience for us, specifically Medicaid, and some of them may not.
And I just want to, you know, bring back, you know, Commissioner Shaw's charge to the group, I think, from the last meeting also, which is that with the growth in medical expense and a potential spike in additional eligibles coming down the line with health care reform, If we're not successful at some of this stuff, we go back to the tools that we've had in the previous toolbox, which is across-the-board cuts, which really just further damage the fabric of care.
So I think the challenge here is not just to think about the benefits so that we can make room for new stuff that would be nice to cover. It's also to begin to run an intelligent benefit design so that we could cover some more people and not have to resort to the same tools we've used previously.
Just a follow-up.
Dr. Shaw?
Yes.
Hang on a second. We just have to turn up the volume.
Thank you, Greg, for restating that. I just wanted to add one more thing. You know, we will, the floodgates will open, and at some point we will be getting a lot of proposals on new benefits to add or things to cover. And the way I see it is you guys have been picked for a reason because of the expertise you bring to the table and your perspective. What this offers, these proposals, are perspectives from the front line in practice, in clinical care, that may have a more nuanced understanding of the benefits and drawbacks of a specific proposal. So to the extent that our expertise and understanding of what we need to do for Medicaid happens to overlap with one or more of these other proposals, they certainly can help inform the process. So I don't think of them, you know, perhaps the process of how we've sent them out will perhaps batch them better, things like that. But these are opportunities where we can learn from the field and then add on to whatever else that you are all bringing to the table. So I hope, you know, we're into our second meeting already. We have two meetings left that we will have a substantial work product that includes real new proposals that will, you know, cut some services and add some others and ultimately improve the quality of the program substantially as a result of both cuts and new add-on.
Will you all need legislative authority to set up that sort of gray matter committee, the gray zone committee, whatever you want to call it, the technical? Is that part of the problem?
It depends on what.
I mean, why aren't you doing it now?
It depends on what the group structure is. So why don't we hold that thought until we get to talking about the process?
So I think I may be asking the same question. Is there a systematic way of going about this, or have you just picked some very good examples where other states have found that they've done the analysis and then you can report out what they say? Or is it going to go through A to Z, or is it simply going to be identified by some other group or by this group?
So while Henry's the psychiatrist, I'm going to play one. What do you think? So the ones that were picked were not exactly at random. But this isn't the list of things that we want this group to deliberate on. This is some things to kind of get us thinking. I would say we would welcome help from the group in either a process for how we would sift through and sort out, or better yet, even specific recommendations based on either information we have or that you have about areas that you think would be right to do that. And, again, that's something we don't need legislation for, developing that process. But just to echo what Dr. Shaw said, I think that, you know, we gathered you to help us sort of do that and to focus on that. And so don't make more of what's up here than is. It's really just a place to start some conversation.
Well, being in managed care, as I recall, Jason Halgerson's been out there saying that the intent of Department of Health is to get out of the claims business and send everybody into managed care, and likewise. When you start, you know, I clearly understand that if, say, for example, you're talking about the carotid artery stents and all that, you're not going to cover it. It's pretty straightforward. It's black and white. There's no evidence like to show it's a really good benefit. There's a lot of harm and all that. When you get into these grayer areas, and I know Dr. Hannon will be talking about the angioplasties and prior authorization was thrown out there, if you're shifting it all to managed care, that's not going to be your problem. It's going to become my problem. And I'm sort of trying to get some clarity as to whether is the Department of Health going to be partnering with the managed care entities to be able to back them up in terms of, if I'm going to prior off certain procedures, are you going to be behind me stating, yeah, we fully support this, or am I out there hanging by myself trying to create whatever criteria that I'm going to come up with, because that makes a huge difference in terms of where things are headed.
Foster, maybe before you answer that, there was a comment about it's a never event, but we can put it on the prior auth. If you have a procedure whereby you have absolutely no evidence of benefits, and you're clearly saying it's a never event, but then putting it on the prior auth, how are you driving the prior auth? What's the individual who's making the prior auth decision supposed to base their decision on, rather than their own personal experience? So all I was going to suggest is somewhere in this process, we help define how prior auth should be done and what criteria should be used for prior auth to allow either the state in determining a benefit to the group or a managed care plan, so that, because otherwise if it's a never event and you say there's no evidence and you take 10 different individuals who are going to provide this prior auth, you will probably get cut down the middle 50-50, half saying yes, half saying no.
Yeah, the language is unfortunate, and again, I would say think less about the specific examples and whether it's right that a never event should even have prior authorization or should just be taken off the list. But I think it was meant as an example of ways of thinking about different kinds of procedures and so on. So my response to Joe, your question is that I think we have to, there are two things. One is we as a state, it's not your problem, it's our problem.
Right.
And actually, first I'd say it's actually all of our problems because, again, we're dealing with a taxpayer-supported public insurance program that is under stress and strain that we all, you know, participate in one way or the other. So it is our mutual problem and challenge and opportunity to think about how we deliver the best set of benefits that we can. So absolutely, we're your partners, and this is your partners, and others are your partners in doing that. And we have different levers that we have to think about. One lever is, you know, the benefit isn't there, period. The other is, the benefit should be managed in this particular fashion. Do we tell all plans that they should manage in that in the same way? Maybe. Maybe yes, maybe no. We've not done a lot of that to date. But it's a new world with new ideas, and, you know, as Arnie, you know, stipulated, maybe we should have a conversation about how you do prior auth or what you do prior auth on. I don't know if this group will get into or how far down that road of details this group will be able to do, but I think there may be some principles and some concepts about it. And there's no question that the implementation of benefit and benefit design and benefit implementation and evaluation needs to include the plans. And one of the challenges of thinking about what decisions we make is what does that mean for how health plans deal with whatever decisions are made. That challenge exists now. So I wouldn't say this is entirely new. That is, we in fee-for-service make certain rules about how we pay, how much we pay, whether there's prior auth, whether there is any kind of stipulations, or whether it's all retro. We just let OMIG go after folks. I mean, those decisions are being made now for a very small subset of procedures, and plans are coming to their own conclusions about whether they follow or don't follow our specific path on payment approach, payment amount, utilization review criteria, and so on. So I think it's up for conversation about whether, there should be more consistency or more, top-down or let a thousand flowers of utilization review approaches bloom, but communicate that this is an area where there's challenges relative to appropriateness or there should be certain criteria. Does that answer?
Yeah, I think it does to a degree where, again, I want to be reassured that, okay, if you're saying that, if everything's coming my way to manage, I want to have the backup behind me with the Department of Health saying, look, this is our recommended set of guidelines or whatever that this is kind of based on. Because, I can give you one example. Back surgery, the rates of it in the Rochester area are a quarter of what they are in the Buffalo region, okay? And, getting into the Dartmouth Atlas world, that's a for real thing. And to be able to have a set of criteria and have people backing me up with a lot of muscle saying, yeah, we're behind you on this, then you don't get into these conversations, I know more than you do because I'm an orthopedist or a neurosurgeon, and it's been my experience, and the criteria that you have there really isn't that good. I mean, that's the type of stuff we're going to be dealing with here.
Well, I don't envision a world in which people never argue. But I do envision part of the goal and the vision of the process is to have a more transparent and evidence-based and agreed-upon decision-making.
And that would help a lot.
So it's not necessarily even the state saying, backing you up, but the evidence and the process contributing to those decisions and backing you up, if that makes sense.
Well, better than where we are now.
Okay.
Is there another group that's looking specifically at pharmacy, or is that kind of part of this whole conversation too?
We had a relatively large set of pharmacy reforms that were advanced as part of the first round of MRT, so we really are trying to keep this group focused on, to the full extent possible, medical non-pharmacy, but there's certainly, if there's pharmacy issues that should be brought to the table, they could be brought here. But we have a variety of mechanisms right now. We've been collecting specific thoughts on pharmacy. But again, the structure that we nailed together, particularly as it relates to weighing evidence against practice, could also be used to weighing evidence against pharmaceuticals. And I think Dr. Lehman was talking a little bit about that last meeting.
I have a couple of questions or statements. One is, I think when we lay out this process, it would be helpful. You had mentioned that prior authorization was one of the ways of managing inappropriate utilization. If we could spell out and understand what that continuum looks like, especially as you move forward, that it's just not never prior or whatever, so that it's extensive and that it makes sense. And it's related to that 20 limit physical therapy rule that was passed. I don't know. I'd like to understand how that came about. And I think the 20, from who I've spoken to, seems like an appropriate number, and no one should really exceed that. But there may be patients, or humans, that may need additional. And the way it's laid out is never. So putting it into context and maybe having that continuum in the process then would allow for those people who really need, not only in a rare disease situation, but in real life practical terms, have access to those services.
Excellent question, and it's a nice maybe learning moment for the group in terms of where we were at prior to this group and where we hoped to be at after this group. So we were faced with a decision about trying to take $2 billion out of the healthcare system to balance the state's budget. There were several proposals to eliminate optional services, including therapies, OT, PT, and speech. The proposal to do the hard 20 cap was a desire to achieve a middle way that would not stop the benefit, but would provide benefit but limit it. And it really was implemented in a vacuum of having this kind of tool to lay evidence against each of those therapies, which, by the way, is harder than hard, as we all know. Without this kind of a toolbox, we defaulted to that kind of proposal, and that was not the favorite proposal of any of the policy staff that were advancing various options for restructuring the benefit against cost. But it's what we had in the toolbox at the time. So hopefully we come out of this meeting with something a little bit more intelligent and surgical.
And then we would be able to review that in a more diligent kind of due process way.
Theoretically, yes. Theoretically, yes. I mean, what was implemented is what was implemented, but it was without this tool.
Okay. I had one other question. Did this, and I'm not a physician, disclosure. In this state, wherever they did this low back pain thing, was there any evaluation of an increase in back surgery or in not the use of low back pain as a diagnosis anymore, but maybe another diagnosis? And at the end, what was done here, was it really offset by greater expenses because then people weren't getting maybe immediate relief, but now they went through this whole back surgery deal?
Yeah, great question. A couple of things around low back pain. There were a number of reports, and you can see here that one of them had to do with imaging relative to low back pain. The other had to do with
these specific interventions that were cost factors they were concerned about, they wanted to look at those to see if there was any evidence that they were efficacious. And so while the short answer is, to my knowledge, the states that have implemented this have not then studied whether or not there was an increase in back surgery as a result. On the other hand, there's pretty good evidence that that the longer you delay, for the most part, for just sort of chronic low back pain, the longer you delay big interventions, generally the better your outcomes are going to be. It's a waxing and waning syndrome that comes and goes, and to the extent that you can keep, there are exceptions. Red flags are a great way of looking at it. People can have cancer that can be deteriorating their spine. There are a number of other conditions that where more aggressive interventions required. But for a large share of these interventions don't have any evidence that they're efficacious, so that they decrease pain. I mean, the studies, if you look at the studies, they just basically say, there's irritation at the site, but there was no difference in terms of the pain that the patient felt between the active intervention and a placebo. So it's,
so Mark,
that's the way in which they've been using them.
So let me answer that. You got evaluation on the brain, Paloma, because all of these things get to, what's the impact. So there are intentional and unintentional consequences, I think, to any benefit decision. It's as true for coverage as it is for non-coverage or limitations of coverage. And so, again, we should circle back to this. Very often it's very difficult, and folks don't do a very good job of trying to figure out what the unintentional consequences are of coverage or of non-coverage. But it's a really important point that I want that you keep mentioning, or at least to me, I keep putting in the same category, that we shouldn't forget. One more comment. It's lunches are here. Dr. Chowdhury, you can go. Then we'll regroup and see how we can speed up a little bit when we come back and get to some of the other issues that we want to cover. You can't bring food in here for some reason. So there's rooms over there. Eat fast and come back. That's what I'll say. Eat fast. Be a New Yorker. Chow it down. Don't choke, but come back, and then we'll start as soon. We'll give maybe like 15 minutes, but one last comment. Why don't you do it now?
I think we've talked a lot about evidence, and I think that's the foundation for what we need to do, but I think we're mixing up a couple of things. So evidence is roughly a tool to inform judgment, and the judgment's what's needed for benefit design. And there are procedures which have been well described to do this. Right? So the real question is two different ideas than evidence. One is appropriateness of care, and the second is the necessity of care. So it strikes me that what our group could best do, rather than going through individual benefit decisions, is to describe process through which appropriateness and necessity or something like that can be made explicit. I think the continuous discussion of evidence and how to judge it, I think, is important, but you need to understand what the appropriateness of care is, and there's procedures defined to do that. So I think that would be something to just maybe it's when we describe the process, but I think evidence is going to be a tool to do that, but that's not what the process is going to look like.
Right. I think some of these examples are around appropriateness problems that we have with some evidence-based, and what we're trying to do is sort of make sort of level the playing field about and create some examples about what those are and then talk about how we might deal with those.
I just think it's right now that we're getting mixed up a little bit.
Dr. Shah, are you still on?
Yes.
So we're gonna break. Did you want to make any pre-break comments? Or hopefully we'll come back in about 15 minutes. I don't know how much time you have.
Yeah, I'm here for the duration now. So let's talk during the break, Foster, and let's catch up.
Okay.
Thanks.
So,
who's there? 120.